I was good at using spreadsheets to like create, not like being an actuary, but to create sort of probabilities of how much can we artificially deflate our price to win the bid, knowing that there's this much upside once we win it. And so that's the game that it's like, I was good at it, but I didn't like it. For one, like, again, put the morality aside, it's like 80% of my job is kind of meaningless, because I'm meaningless in the sense that I'm doing this pricing agreement that isn't actually going to be adhered to in a meaningful way. It feels like a big waste of time. But then I realized, kind of big picture, if this is wasting this much of my time, like zoom out to the entire industry, like we knew as a company like that, that responding to a corporate RFP was a six-figure investment just to respond to the RFP.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the GMI Rocket Show. Today is episode number 74. I'm your host, Roman Zelichenko. I'm a former immigration attorney turned entrepreneur. I'm the co-founder of Laborless, which is an immigration tech startup that automates H-1B visa compliance, and also the founder of GMI Rocket, which is a digital marketing agency for the immigration and mobility industry, and of course brings you this show, the GMI Rocket Show. Today, as I said, episode number 74, we're going to have a really interesting conversation with a founder, a co-founder of a company that is also fairly niche in the problem that it solves within the global mobility industry, which I love because labor, you know, for me, niche, relatively niche companies are very exciting. But of course, the company has, it touches so many different stakeholders. Our guest today is Ryan Kintz. He is the co-founder and president of PricePoint. The website is pricepointmoves.com. So PricePoint is a company that basically provides pricing transparency and more real-time pricing and price information for the moving industry. So, and it brings together multiple stakeholders within the moving industry. As an immigration lawyer, I never thought about moving. You know, I always thought about the visa process, the legal process. And then, of course, once you get the visa, great, everything must be done. Well, no, it's not. There's a whole gamut of things that need to be done, which part of which is the person actually physically moving their stuff and their, you know, their families and to their new location. And obviously moving companies are a huge part of that. So I'm really excited to dive into this topic today. Without further ado, let's bring in Ryan. Ryan, thank you so much for being here. I'm super excited to learn your story and honestly learn a lot more about the moving industry too, because I'm the first one to say it. I don't know a whole lot about the sort of intricacies of it. So thank you for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's great.
You are in California, right?
Right now. Bay Area. Yep.
Yeah. And so, and you know, we talked about this, I know kind of previously a little bit, but PricePoint is a tech company. I mean, it's a tech company, right? I mean, you're sitting in the moving mobility industry, but the service that you provide is a technological platform. I'm just curious, before we dive into the story, you know, you moved to California, to the Bay Area for the tech scene. Do you feel like the mobility industry is, you know, as techy as you thought it would be when you kind of first moved to the industry or to the area to pursue PricePoint?
The mobility industry, yeah, I think it's kind of on schedule. By that, I mean it's a couple decades behind other industries, but that makes sense when it comes to, you know, where VCs and tech money focuses their attention. It makes sense that the mobility industry isn't as advanced because it hasn't had that outside investment come in. But that's also been kind of an advantage because we can actually speculate on where the industry is going by seeing what other industries have done and just recognize, okay, well, that path is going to be a little bit different for this industry, but still you can kind of see the big picture effects of what the future of the industry will be. It's just how long does it take to get there?
And we sort of don't have to experiment because we can learn from all these other industries that, you know, blossom to $47 billion valuations and then, you know, come crashing down. I'm thinking of WeWork right now. So, and I'm really excited to talk to you about the investment world too, and kind of how it fits into our industry. Cause you know, I come from the kind of sort of immigration side of things, obviously, which fits into the broader global mobility ecosystem. And it's increasing. The interest from venture capital and outside investors is certainly increasing in the space, but it's still not anywhere near, you know, what, electric vehicles or, you know, plethora of other social media apps, you know, what they've received in the past. So I'm excited to talk to you about kind of what you're seeing there as well. I want to bring it back to kind of the beginning, right? Because for me, the interesting The interesting story is first and foremost the founder's story, right? And then, of course, the company itself and the industry. So you spent 20 years about in the moving industry, but you grew up in Chicago, is that right?
No, kind of a Midwest nomad. I was actually born in a small town in South Dakota, kind of small town where you know you're not in the town anymore because you're in a cornfield, but no memories of that. My parents moved away from there before my first birthday. We moved to the comparative metropolis of Sioux City, Iowa, which is like right on the border with Iowa and Nebraska. Halfway through my childhood, my dad's job moved us up to the Minneapolis-St. Paul suburbs. That's where I stayed until graduating high school. Ended up going to college in Illinois, Central Illinois, Bloomington. Shout out to Illinois Wesleyan University. It's about an hour's drive south of Chicago. Mm-hmm. Because of that proximity, kind of ended up in Chicago after college.
What was your dad doing that kind of had you guys moving around quite a bit?
Telecom. And in fact, my senior year of high school, his job was potentially going to be moving again. So, you know, that stage where we're all figuring out where we're going to go and do you want to stay close to home or go out of state? I didn't even know what that was going to be. So it was just kind of like, well, you know, cast a wide net and ended up in Illinois. My dad ended up taking that job. So in fact, it was literally the day after I graduated high school, a Mayflower truck was outside our door. Sending my whole family away. I ended up staying in Minneapolis for that summer, staying at a friend's spare bedroom. But yeah, like, so moving has been kind of part of my story since.
That's interesting. And actually, that brings me to kind of a question. I mean, as a kid, okay, so your first move that you don't remember, you were really young. When was that second move from Sioux City to the Minneapolis suburbs? Like, how do you remember how old you were about?
Oh, yeah, I was end of fourth grade. And something I've thought about before is like, so I've lived in 7 U.S. states and 3 countries. And like the biggest culture shock of any of them was moving from Iowa to Minnesota.
Wow.
Yeah. And this includes I've lived in the UK, I've lived in Russia. Moving to Minnesota from Iowa was like the biggest, like most challenging one of all of them.
That's fascinating. Can you, how so?
In short terms, I was going from a smaller town, small Catholic, like private Catholic school, to a suburban public school. Mm-hmm. And just whole different culture.
That's so funny. Yeah, you'd hear that, you know, going across the world, but to think that you can move a couple of states over. And so, and I'm curious, you know, you said fourth grade, right? When you moved there. So what do you, and, you know, again, because you're in the moving industry now and you spent 20 years, almost 20 years in it professionally as well. What do you remember about the move? Like, because I think it's important that you are also a consumer of the service, right? And not just sort of on the supplier side. What do you remember about it? I'm curious, because I will say this. My family immigrated to the U.S. From the former Soviet Union when I was 2.5. I don't remember it, you know, and my whole life, basically, I mean, we moved once maybe when I was 5, 6 or 7. But I don't really remember that, you know, too much either. It was sort of, but I, you know, as a kid, it's hard to move. Right. And I'm curious, just from your perspective, if you have any memories, you're excited or you were sad or nervous or anything like that.
Oh, yeah. Like, I definitely remembered before that, like, you know, when you're in school and there's the new kid that comes in. And I always like felt sorry for the new kid. And I was like, didn't want to be that guy. But then it eventually happened. And also, like, I had really good friends where I grew up and we were outside playing baseball and football every day after school. And so, like, I definitely didn't want to move. But it happened. But I think what was kind of interesting is as it's happening, it's exciting for a period of time, like leading up to it and doing it and moving, and you stay in a hotel for a week. And it was a little adventure. But yeah, I mean, I was definitely apprehensive because being the new kid isn't fun. And I actually knew like that's kind of what lays ahead. And I think that's a challenge for everyone, right?
That's interesting. So you sort of knew that when you would see a quote unquote, you know, the new kid, you kind of, because you knew the nature of your dad's work, I guess, there was always a potential that may happen to you.
I don't think I saw that, but I just saw that it's a thing that happens. It's like, mm-hmm. I hope me or my best friends don't move away someday. Yeah. But yeah,
that happened. But that's so interesting. Yeah, no. And that's, you know, you think about moving as an adult, like for new business opportunities or work opportunities, and it's really exciting. But yeah, for kids, it can be quite tough, you know, especially because your friends are your world really when you're young, and you don't really know, you don't look at things as opportunities because you don't really know to do that. That's really fascinating. So you grew up in the Minneapolis suburbs, right? And then you went away to college in Illinois. Did you have any thought about what you wanted to do? I know you studied international business, I think, right? And mm-hmm. Russian, right? Mm-hmm. So do you speak Russian, any Russian at all by any chance still?
It's very, very rusty.
Very rusty. Haven't next time we'll have this interview in Russian to practice. But you studied international business. Was there anything related to, like, what was your thinking there? I'm curious.
I had very little direction coming out of high school. Wasn't sure. The college did have an official undecided major, so I was that for my entire freshman year, and I think even going into my second year, hoping something would kind of grab me. So I think I always thought business would be the fallback position, but I resisted a little bit, seemed a little mundane. Meanwhile, I was taking my first year courses, and I really like economics. I was liking like the history courses and kind of that worldview. And that's essentially how I ended up with international business, because it's kind of that business administration template, but with layers of this broader focus of economics and foreign relations, international finance, things like that. So that seemed like that made it more interesting to me. So I thought, let's do this. The program did have a requirement that you spend at least one semester studying abroad, which I think to most people, and even myself a little bit, like that's apprehensive in itself. But since I had this experience of moving around kind of bit, I was kind of accustomed to it. Like even when I was in Minnesota, that area, this is like late 80s, early 90s, that area was just booming with growth. Like telecom was coming there and other industries were coming there. And there was constantly new schools opening up, and school districts were being redistricted. So from like fifth grade until the end of high school, I think I went to like six different schools, even though we didn't move. So it was like moving without moving. I kept being the new guy over and over again, even though my house wasn't moving. But again, the point is like going to college, and it's like, oh, study abroad. Okay. No big deal. Right. And so I ended up doing two semesters abroad. Like I went to London, and while I'm in Europe, and I'm decided to minor in Russian. So I spent a semester in Moscow as well.
Wow. It's actually really cool to have that experience of, like you said, kind of being the new person over and over, because you sort of learn how to deal with that. And I would imagine it makes you feel more comfortable or confident just being in new situations in general. I mean, how much social anxiety is it to kind of walk into a new room, you know, go to a networking event where you don't know people within the industry or whatnot. But if you sort of have that experience of constantly introducing yourself, you know, meeting new people, or at least just being there without having others around you who you already know, that's right. Pretty good. That's pretty good practice for life, I think.
Yeah.
Did you travel internationally before you did the study abroad program ever with like your family, maybe on vacation or something?
No. Yeah. When I studied abroad in London, is the first time I left the country, I think.
Yeah. Wow. Do you remember that? Was that a thought that you had, like, wow, I'm leaving the US? Or were you kind of just, this is the program I'm doing and I'm going for it?
Yeah, I was just kind of going with the flow, but I kind of remember it's like, so I know I'm going to London, and it was kind of like, I have no sense of what that means, like what London is like, right? Other than National Lampoon's European Vacation or whatever else. But like, that's the thing that I've picked up traveling around, is all these different places have their own feel to them. And you even like reflect back on it, you can like remember what it felt like to be there. But that's kind of what I was thinking, is like, London was this very abstract thing place that I knew of, but I had no sense of what it was like. And going there for 4 months, like, totally changed that and kind of filled it in, and gives you a broader sense of how the world works, I guess.
That's so cool. Okay. So Ryan, I wanted to ask, you know, you studied abroad, you had this great experiences, you got to travel internationally for the first time. You know, and you eventually, I know you had another job in right after college, but then you eventually fell into the moving industry, right?
I actually went straight into
You went straight into it. So how did that happen? Can you talk a little bit about that? Because not many people know what the moving industry is unless you already have a connection to it. So how did you come across that?
There's actually a really weird wrinkle that I experienced, which I'll talk about briefly because maybe other people had this. So I was an international business major. And so coming out of that last year of college is when you're throwing your resume in at the career center and all these different opportunities, you know, jobs are getting posted and you put your resume there. Mm-hmm. And that last year I was living in an apartment with three other guys. The three other guys were all business majors. I was international business. Objectively, I had the best resume of the four guys. I'd studied abroad while I was in Europe. I even did two internships while I was in Europe. I had a magna cum laude GPA. So really great, you know, resume. And me and my three roommates were all putting our resumes in for the same jobs. And over the coming weeks, they were all getting interviews and I wasn't. Like, what's going on here? And I actually went and talked to the career center about this and like, am I doing something wrong? And they were kind of perplexed. So the head of the career center actually called up a few of these corporations. I mean, we're talking like big known brands and got the same response from all of them. Well, we're recruiting for business majors, not international business majors. Trying to make sense of that could like take a long time. It's weird, but I'm curious if anyone else had that kind of experience. But to get to the point, one day there was a posting and as I quickly perused it, it actually said, you know, searching for degrees in international business or international studies. I'm like, whoa, wow. What is this? And it was from Allied Van Lines. I'm like, what? Why do they need, you know, international studies or whatever? So like, I think for most people, we don't realize on the outside that there's this whole industry of international moving that's attached to the big moving trucks that we normally think of. So they were recruiting they were starting this new program. So shout out to many of you might know a guy named Jim Petzl. It was his program as well as Jack Griffin, who's now the head guy at Atlas. He was head of sales and marketing at Allied at the time. And they kind of sponsored this program where they were recruiting in specifically international business into their Chicago headquarters. And the broad brushstrokes is we're going to try to teach you as much as we can about the business in 2 years and then potentially feed you out into our network, because they, of course, had this network across the US and around the world. So there's like, I didn't necessarily know if I wanted to go overseas for work, but it's like, well, that's definitely an interesting option, right? And meanwhile, no one else is giving me an interview. It was, you know, you could look at it from like a fate or destiny thing that they were specifically recruiting for that thing. And it was a perfect fit.
Wow.
It's kind of cool too. Like, you know, a month out of college, what I got grounded in, that program put us right into international operations, which is the forwarding and the coordination that happens behind the scenes. That's like crucial to how the industry works. And so I spent about a year or two in that, which is just invaluable in terms of having a real tangible nuts and bolts feel for how the industry works. Because in many years later, designing price point, you have to reflect on having that tangible insight about what's actually going to work versus what's not realistic. You got to anticipate how the industry will react to something that you're building, right? So it was just really valuable that I started in the operations coordination side to get that really grounded perspective of how it worked.
What do you remember from those earlier days? I mean, you sort of came in as an insider into the moving space, as an outsider into the moving space. To your point, you know, perhaps not really knowing what that means, especially from an international standpoint. Do you remember thinking to yourself, oh, this is weird, you know, the way something works, whether in a good way or a bad way? You know, I'm just wondering if you had any sort of initial thoughts or insights getting into the moving space when you were just learning.
I suppose it's just, you know, the kind of thing where there's so much depth and dimension to whatever industry you get into that you just wouldn't even conceive of from the outside. But to take that in a little bit different direction, maybe I'm there at the Chicago headquarters and the company has this really big umbrella of companies around the world or offices around the world. And, you know, as you're in a team of other coordinators, you know, typical talk is things like, man, I hate it when our office in France does blah, blah, blah. Or, you know, why do the guys in Singapore always do it this way? Get that kind of perspective. And then, so fast forward a little bit, the program actually did like play out like they anticipated. 2 years later, I got sent on an overseas assignment, actually back to London, which was great because I love London from being there. And it's a little bit the easy button. Like, I already know this. And I know that how to get on the tube. I know all the tricks and all that. So that was great. But it was like when the opportunity came up, part of what I consciously recognize is like, I do want to go over there and see what they're saying about the Chicago office.
Oh, right? Interesting.
And sure enough, it was exact opposite. And I became the focal point of their complaints, of course, because I'm here, the guy visiting from the Chicago office. And it's like them asking me to explain what those Yanks are doing over in Chicago. But that was like part of what I wanted to accomplish is kind of get a second perspective in the industry, because there was definitely a lot of like, you know, a lot of inter-office friction just because of all kinds of nuances that you can't appreciate until you go there. And then you hear the other side of the story.
You know, and I have to commend you for wanting, for like intuiting that there is another side, right? And not just blindly following the opinions and thoughts and perhaps complaints of the folks you're working with, you know, in let's say the Chicago office. Because you're right, it's always about like the context and the perspective. It's also really interesting because, I mean, I guess perhaps it's a little bit of a fast forward, but, you know, for price point, you sit in the middle of the industry in a way.
Right.
And so here you're already thinking as a focal point. You were thinking, let me get information from Singapore, from Paris, from Chicago, from other offices. And like, you must have had some sort of maybe subconscious like intuition that I can solve this problem. I just need more data about what all the different moving pieces are and what their complaints are. There must be some holistic way of solving this. I don't know. Did you ever have that? Or is it sort of like in hindsight, looking at it that way, it makes sense?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely wanted to get the other perspective, but I had no sense of what it might lead to. And then many years later, I definitely drew on the experience explicitly to think, okay, I'm building this prototype thing. I need to think of how would this look to the person in a US headquarters where I'd started versus a European branch office versus later after London, coming back to Chicago for a while. I later had an opportunity where I ended up in Texas working for the Darrell Flood Organization, essentially running their international division. And I didn't seek out that opportunity. Like it kind of, in less than a month, I moved to Texas before even knowing that it was an opportunity, but it kind of came up quickly. And again, I'm like ready to roll. But it was again, I consciously, I liked the opportunity because there's this very different perspective, even within the US, of when you're at a US corporate headquarters versus at the agent level. And Darrell Flood was, you know, one of the larger, very highly respected brands. So I was just, it was a great opportunity to go there. But it was, again, I want to actually see how the agents think. And the best way to do that is to become one of them and see what their view is on corporate, because there's always been a lot of kind of tension between those two entities.
That's fascinating. It's so interesting that you're driven to that kind of experience, you know, versus maybe not caring, right? Or just kind of putting your head down, working, moving up on the ladder, et cetera. Sure. So let's talk about that a little bit. So you were at Allied for a number of years, right? And then you moved over to Darrell Flood and in Texas. So was there anything that you kind of took away there? Because that was, you know, your second job. Now you have seen the moving industry from, you know, second vantage point, right? From another company. Did you have any inclination at this point that, you know, maybe you would start something someday or, you know, starting to solve some problem in your head that you continue to see, one place after another? Or was it just sort of like you said, at that point, you were learning, you were interested in a new opportunity. I guess it was another chance to move, which is kind of cool. So,
sure. So I skipped over between London and Texas when I was back in Chicago, back there for 3 or 4 years. And that's where I had really the most important, most formative experience that ultimately gave me the insights for price point. I was the international pricing manager for a few years. And there's a whole lot we may or may not want to dig into there, but 20% of my job was managing pricing from like internally from our network of agents and other suppliers and freight companies and things like that. The bulk of my work was when corporations go out to RFP for moving services, particularly international moving services, I was the guy in the back office that did all the complex pricing to respond to that RFP. And so I was actually in between those two parts of our whole agent network and our whole corporate. And that's where I witnessed just all of this dysfunction between the two of them. And I actually got very, very good at that job. Like that job, more than anything, probably kind of like was the catalyst for my career and how I ended up down at Daryl Flood. I was really good at the job, but I didn't like that. I didn't like that I was good at it. Or I didn't like the game that we were playing. I was good at the game, but I didn't like the game.
And can I ask you, Ryan, what did it mean for you to be good at that job? Like, what were you doing that you were? What was the game, I guess, if you can define it?
The game is that, and let me be clear, I am not in any way being critical of like movers or the moving industry. They're not the villains. It's not their fault. But there hasn't been a best practice for corporations on how to procure these services. Okay. So they're often like someone in procurement's putting together some kind of template, a spreadsheet, whatever, and using that as their tender that they go out to market. Long story short, that ends up with pricing agreements that aren't really meaningful. Some are more than others, but I've never seen a really good corporate RFP. I've seen RFPs that have varying degrees of badness. And so what that means is like, if you create a system where there's an incentive to cheat, you're going to end up with cheating. Like, spare me the morality. This is the reality. So I was good at my job for two reasons. One, all the chaos internally within the industry, like 80% of the industry, like adhered to certain unspoken protocols about how you do pricing, but it was not formalized by anyone. There was about 20% variance, let's say. So part of it was taking all of that incongruous pricing protocols and using spreadsheets to manage them. Hmm. Okay. And now I've got to like adapt that pricing to these corporations who are just coming up with all these different templates that they're just, you know, they're coming out of nowhere. And some of them share templates that have floated around the industry. And again, they're all terrible. But so the other part that I was good at with my job is the first thing I would do when I got a new RFP that came through is I would just look at it holistically and how well was this put together? In other words, how big are the loopholes? Some have small loopholes, some have medium loopholes, some have large loopholes. And that dictates how aggressive you are with your pricing. So if there's an RFP with like larger loopholes, well, we can get even more aggressive with our pricing, meaning lower the pricing because we don't think we're not going to be held to it in a meaningful way, or you're held to some of it, but not other parts. And again, this is the behavior that's forced on the industry by bad procurement. I was good at using spreadsheets to like create, not like being an actuary, but to create sort of probabilities of how much can we artificially deflate our price to win the bid, knowing that there's this much upside once we win it. And so that's the game that it's like, I was good at it, but I didn't like it. For one, like, again, put the morality aside. It's like 80% of my job is kind of meaningless because I'm meaningless in the sense that I'm doing this pricing agreement that isn't actually going to be adhered to in a meaningful way. It feels like a big waste of time. But then I realized kind of big picture, if this is wasting this much of my time, like zoom out to the entire industry, like we knew as a company like that, that responding to a corporate RFP was a six-figure investment just to respond to the RFP. So I just had a vague sense that there's a lot of opportunity. But even within that role, I think I kind of have a bit of a recessive entrepreneurial gene. And for a minute or so, I kind of had the thought, you know, I've gained a lot of knowledge about how this really works on the inside. Maybe what I could do is be a consultant and go out to these companies and help guide them through this process. Hmm. For various reasons, I didn't do that. But one of them was because I realized I didn't really have a magic bullet on how to fix it. Like I could give them consultation and tips, but anything that I would come up with, I could myself figure out ways to exploit it. Like that's the game I'd put my head through. And so I didn't know what that silver bullet was, but I kept kind of casually obsessing about it for the next maybe 5 years of my career, including when I went down to Texas. And years later, I kind of had the classic eureka moment of, and maybe it's more of a series of eureka moments of how it could be fixed. in a way that basically it's like, if you want a system that doesn't, where there's no cheating, you have to get rid of the incentive to cheat. And so that's kind of been one of our guiding principles on how to design the market.
I love that. And by the way, I will say that I think with any industry, you know, especially in an RFP process, even when there is no RFP process, pricing is such an art. There's so much give and take. There's so much subjective value that is placed on one thing for one person that isn't there for another. I can definitely appreciate this idea, this like you said, kind of game with regards to pricing a service, especially if it's a long-term contract, right? I'm assuming, or like right. a one big move. You know, I don't know exactly how, and I'm sure it runs the gamut from, hey, we need some company to help with this move versus, hey, we need some company to help us with every move for the next few years. Like I know there was a whole big, the military moving contract that was in the news or the past year, right? Like those are, and so I appreciate what you're saying about it just being sort of thrust upon providers, and we do what we can. I mean, you got to do what you can to stay alive and run your business and understand the nuances of the industry. But then to your point, you know, that means that the business model is based on this sort of unsaid, unspoken series of norms that maybe doesn't have to exist, or maybe if we speak about them finally, maybe we can institutionalize them and like fix it and then not waste the time, you know, doing all this rigmarole and just kind of move forward with the service. So I love that. I love that story. And so it sounds like you had this idea and you were starting to think about this as you went you moved down to Texas. You then moved to Serva, right? Serva Worldwide, really big relocation.
No, it was Allied Servo would have been altogether.
I see. Sorry, I didn't realize that. See, there's my naivete.
Yeah, no problem. In fact, I started at Allied pre-Serva, and I was there when the whole transition to Serva happened.
Got it.
A couple of years after that, I went down to Texas.
Got it. Okay, so can you talk to me about a little bit? Your job at your role at Texas was basically the last role that you had before you broke off and sort of started to work on PricePoint. So you just shared the background and the context, and you said you had this eureka moment. When did you feel that kind of, I don't know if you'd call it a fire or just the desire to finally say, I have to go work on this, because if I don't do this now, you know, I'm never going to do it, or someone else is going to do it, or whatever. And I asked that question because that's a really difficult decision to make when you have a job. Right. You know, you've now been working for a while, you know, hopefully you're progressing in your salary and your, you know, life. It's hard to just leave that. And when I was working full time, you know, I don't know how many podcasts I listened to, how many books I read, just to give me like, just to hype me up to say, all right, this is it. I'm going to go put in my, you know, I actually put in 6 weeks because I wanted to like,
I read this. Have you ever seen this one?
Founders at Work. I have not. No,
it's great. So yeah, when I had the sort of first eureka moment, and again, I was kind of like casually obsessed with this industry problem for years, not knowing how do you fix it. It's so many layers of dysfunction. And so I had the thought, but then yeah, it was about a 2 year period until I actually started the company. And in the early phases of with that, it's the really fun. Like, you know, everyone has, oh, I've got this great idea for a startup or a website, right? Like these half-baked ideas. But it's been a period of time actually like tinkering around with it and thinking it through. How would this actually work? And meanwhile, like one of the most important and serendipitous parts that made this all possible. So my wife at the time, she had a cousin named David. His name's David Berginski. He lives out here in the Bay Area. Honestly, I think David's the smartest person I've ever met. He's also just super humble and sincere and kind. He's a great person. But I had access to David. Well, why did that matter? When I first met David, he was working at Google. And we're talking like early 2000s Google. I think he was like when it was only 100 or 200 employees big, David was there. He was there for a few years. And one day I hear David's leaving Google. And I say, where's he going? I'm told he's going to Facebook. And my response was, what's Facebook? So he was early at Google, early at Facebook, later followed Dustin Moskovitz. He was one of the Facebook co-founders. He went and started something called Asana David followed him there. David likes working in the small environment and growing it into something massive, but he likes that early phase. And so as I'm tinkering with this idea, I'm seeing David two or three times a year on the holidays, and I kind of pick his brain on things. And that's kind of what helped progress it to the next level, is having someone like him that I could talk through it. Meanwhile, he was actually really intrigued with the idea, and he does like, you know, small projects. So we got to the point where, you got to make that big decision, right? Am I actually going to like leave my job and all that, like a salary and into who knows what? But it was because I had access to someone like David of his incredible caliber. David was willing to co-found the company with me, which meant, so I was going to be the actual hands-on trying to grow the business. But David built like the first prototype, architected the back-end database in Django, did all that stuff. And it's like having access to a guy of that caliber who's going to do that is like, it's just truly priceless, right? Mm-hmm. And so that was almost one of the biggest decision points. It's like, I know I'm onto something here. I know what the ingredients are. I don't know how to put it all together, but I've got access to a guy like David. It's like, yeah, you don't want to sit around the rest of your life wondering, maybe I should have done that. And I almost expected it to fail, but I actually remember thinking, well, at least I'll figure out why it failed instead of wonder about it for the rest of my life. But yeah, so David is a big part of that.
That's really inspiring. Having that kind of a partner is so helpful. So helpful, because especially when you know that you don't have the actual technical ability to build the business, you know, I can appreciate what you're saying, especially from the perspective of, well, let me start a consulting business, because you could have done that yourself. You didn't need a co-founder. That was right. In your head and just providing that service. Now you want to build a technology company. You need somebody who knows how to code. Let me ask you this, because I know I had this thought. Did you ever think to yourself, all right, maybe I should go learn how to code to build out this idea that I had? Did you ever think that?
Maybe a little bit. Yeah. Yeah. Because I'm kind of like that too. When I want to do something, I like to kind of like roll up my sleeves and do it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, fortunately, I don't think I considered that for too long. And it's because I had access to David, right? And it was just this natural fit.
Yeah. No, I've met lawyers who have gone on to, they took a boot, went to one of these coding boot camps and became great developers and moved on to a career in software development. And so a lot of people say, well, why don't you go learn how to code and build it yourself? But we'll get to this in just a moment. But, obviously having a partner and sort of being a specialist in what you're doing and have them specialize in what they're doing is better, frankly. I just think it's better.
And I think you and I briefly touched on this yesterday, that there's this kind of this paradox of you need to be the industry insider to hopefully have a sense of how to fix the industry. So an outsider from the tech side isn't going to have that. But since you are that insider, you probably aren't a tech person. You've got your, whatever industry you're in, you've got your expertise there. So that's kind of the inherent paradox, particularly when, like we said much earlier, this industry doesn't have a lot of outside investment coming at it as well. So there's that inherent challenge of all industries have insiders who probably know how to fix it, but don't have the resources or know where to start. Because in fact, when I had the Eureka moment, I very quickly realized that the solution was tech platform based. And this is circa, like, let's say 2008 or so, when more of this stuff is more and more mainstream. So I could kind of see how it'd be. But the moment I realized that it's a tech solution, I almost like, well, that's not me. Like, I almost just instantly wrote it off, because like, it was almost like, I was like, well, this is what someone's going to do someday. This is where the industry is going to go. But I almost dismissed that I could do it or play a part in it. But that's where, having fidgeted around with the idea for a while, I kind of like slowly inched myself up to that line. And then having access to David kind of was the big leap across it.
I can appreciate that more than you can imagine. Let me ask you then the important question. When you and David started working on this, what was price point? because I want to get to what is price point. And I'm wondering, what was price point at the time? And, so, and you know, when you first started working on it, and what was the concept behind it? And I think that would be a really nice segue into, well, what does the company do today?
Yeah. And so you said, what was it like in our mind early on?
Yeah.
Right. Because it was very vague. Eureka moment. Like the first one, I was at Daryl Flood and we were participating in a big corporate RFP, and I was doing, normally I would have shipped that off to the corporate office to do it, but since it was my old job, I did it myself. But I was just running through the same motions. Like, it means I'm going to spend 5 hours architecting a spreadsheet structure that will uniquely solve this RFP. And in the middle of it, I was like, it was like 6 o'clock in the evening. Everyone else had left. I'm still working on this dumb RFP. And I just had the random thought, like, this would be a lot easier if the corporate buyers would do their pricing the same way that the industry does itself. And I was like, wait a minute, what did I just, you know, think? Like, that was the interesting insight, was like, there's these layers of dysfunction in large part because one side of the audience is doing pricing in this totally irrational way. And then within the industry, it's a bit more rational, but it's unstandardized and very analog. People are literally sending pricing via email and PDFs and spreadsheets, not standardized. And like, I have a compulsion for efficiency, I think. And just seeing that opportunity where you could solve two problems with one platform, that's what I realized was a big part of the opportunity, just from a big efficiency standpoint. So what was price point? In startup world, you hear about pivots a lot, right? Now, pivot is usually a euphemism for we effed up the original model.
Right.
We got to rethink it. We actually had like a pre-programmed pivot in a sense. What we did first was say, okay, let's address the inside of the industry first, where there's a bit of uniformity, but it's still like just totally different, all kinds of nuances. So let's make that real. It's like, moving companies in Asia tend to price things per cubic meter. In the US, it's per hundredweight. In Europe, it's per cubic foot. There's things like minimum densities and breakpoints and just these myriad of dimensions that people do their pricing differently. So the first thought was create a platform that the movers can use to exchange pricing amongst themselves, where they can upload their own pricing tariffs, not in like a static PDF, but an actual like fill in these cells. And it was basically a pricing engine, right? So movers in Australia, US, South Africa, wherever, they can put their own pricing tariffs up. And then the moving companies that work with them can go to price point and say, okay, I need destination services for 6,520 pounds to Melbourne, Australia. And price point gives them that. So instead of sending an email and waiting till the next day, they can get that price instantly. Like, not rocket science, right? It seems almost obvious. But the point was to first create that sort of protocol, that base layer protocol for the industry itself, and then pivot to what was the ultimate goal, which was to solve the corporate buying experience. Because that was the big thing that I was kind of obsessed with, is, you know, what a mess all of that was. So it's like, if you solve how the industry works first, now you can actually take that protocol to the corporate and RMC audience, we serve those simultaneously, and say, we've already got all these details figured out. You don't have to try to do it yourself. And meanwhile, it's like the same like templates that you use in what we call our mover to mover environment. It's the same templates that get used in our corporate and RMC environment. So they're just so much inherent efficiency savings by doing that all the same way and not reformatting everything. But that was the basic idea, is like, solve the moving industry first. And from a startup standpoint, we haven't talked about it yet, but we did this purely as a bootstrap startup, meaning no outside funding, other than my own savings, basically. So from a bootstrap standpoint, it's like, okay, that mover to mover model is never going to be hugely lucrative because it's a relatively small addressable market. The model was we basically charge a subscription service to the movers that want to use it, but that was never going to like put us to the moon. It's a small market. Movers are cheap. Sorry, it's true. So getting them to like pay hundreds of dollars a month for a subscription, that's a challenge. But nonetheless, it got us through the first few years of the company where we could actually, it's like, you know, stage one is have an actual viable product. Stage two is get people to actually use it. Stage three is get them to actually pay to use it. Stage four is cover your costs. So it probably took like 3 years to where the business was just covering its cost before even paying me a salary. That's the next stage, pay yourself a salary. And then there's many more stages beyond that we could talk about, but I don't know if you wanted to go anywhere else with this.
Yeah, no, that's perfect. And I think it would be interesting to dive into sort of you had the sort of MVP, I guess, which was to fix the problem on the mover, on the supplier side, mm-hmm. and then use that and leverage that to say, hey, corporates, we've got, and then basically create a marketplace after that, right? So it's really, my question to you before we move on to this sort of where it continued to go, you said you pre-engineered that pivot. So you basically thought to yourself, you and your co-founder, let's first solve this problem for movers, and then we can take that and expand the business. So you had already thought through that from the beginning?
Thought through it in very vague terms. Right. Yeah. But it's also like, you know, you're climbing a mountain and you don't know what you're going to encounter until you're halfway mm-hmm. up, and mm-hmm. you figure it out as you go. But that was the general idea. Address this market first. And that also, like, you build credibility and proof of concept, because if we try to go straight to corporates with like, hey, here's our prototype, like, get out of here. Right. So you build credibility by starting there. I think that was part of it.
So let's talk a little bit about, as you continue to move on, you bootstrapped the company, you created this sort of first iteration, right? And you built credibility. You obviously already had a lot of experience to back you up. So I would imagine if you came to me, I would say, great, I'll at least listen to what you have to say. How did you then go from, you know, this sort of mover only side business to now starting to approach corporates, where, to your point, now you're talking about a big market, you're talking about a big business, you're also talking about creating the real efficiency that you had envisioned from the beginning, you know, this sort of multi-layered efficiency. How did you start to, you know, when did you start to feel comfortable enough to say, let's take it to the next level?
I didn't feel comfortable.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, you know, we talked before that when you're in that kind of bootstrap, you're the chief everything officer. So I was head of sales, which is terrible. I should not be head of sales, but I, you know, you got to put that hat on. And so definitely the first few opportunities that were borderline miraculous, they came through introductions through other colleagues that believed in what I was doing, and they put me in contact. So they kind of lent me some credibility, putting me in contact with a few people. You know, I'd love to like give my thanks to those early clients that had faith in us, but you know, they get a little squirrely about using their brand name. But I'll just say it took, it was a leap of faith that I had to find the right people that had faith to be an early adopter, to share the vision. And of course, they had to have a sense of the pain of the industry from their seat on the corporate side, trying to herd cats, which, you know, pricing in this industry. So it was really like, yeah, I think it came down to, I had to lean on a couple people making the right introductions and then figure it out from there and hopefully win those people over. And fortunately, we won a couple of them over.
And then you started to go to your sort of second tier prospects, and you were able to say, hey, well, we were already working with company X, Y, and Z. So that gives you even more credibility now, I guess. And you sort of, those little stepping stones.
Yeah. Another factor too is what we identified really early on, like I guess I did, is we now use the phrase mover friendly all the time. And I wasn't calling it back in the day, but part of the idea is like, we can do this in a way that the movers actually like it's a win-win for the corporates and the movers. Cause again, I came from the mover side and I hated playing the game that I was forced to play. So it's like, presumably there are other movers who don't like playing this game either. And they would like to help us get to that next level. And we've addressed this in a way. So movers are normally kind of framed as the villain. And it's this, like, there are procurement specialists out there, or more specifically, people know like invoice audit companies. And that is a very adversarial engagement. It's a cat and mouse game, where the movers are kind of cast as they're the crooks and we're the police and we're going to like surveil them to make sure they don't cheat you out of money. And like our approach wanted to be completely different, which is to assume that movers didn't want to play those games. And if we could give them a model that did that, like for me, I felt personally when I was on the mover side of the table, I would much rather play on a level playing field where we're competing on the basis of like logistical expertise and customer service instead of creative pricing, which was really the big differentiator. So yeah, it was kind of this faith that other movers would embrace that. Some did, probably fewer than I expected. Like you always expect you build it and then the world's going to beat a path to your door. No, that doesn't happen. But it definitely helped that, like without a doubt, there's a handful of movers in the industry that we would have never succeeded if they hadn't like helped prop us up in the early years.
That's awesome. Okay. So now we're selling to corporates. Price point is growing. Can you talk a little bit about your growth? So two things that I want to ask you about. Number one is the financing of it. We talked about bootstrap and we also talked about how there's not a lot of venture capital or outside capital coming into the space, but it's growing. Mm-hmm. So, I want to talk about that. And then I also want to talk a little bit about, you know, how you ended up sort of changing the executive structure in the company, because obviously you're the co-founder and president, but you did have a CEO who came in, Ben Heller, who many of us know and love, but who obviously was not there from the very, very early days. And so I want to talk about how kind of that shift happened. But first, I want to talk about the growth period. You know, was there a thought to yourself eventually, especially you're out in Silicon Valley, you know, we always read the TechCrunch headlines, so-and-so raised $50 million, $10 million, $100 million. Did you start to have those conversations early or like how did you view the whole fundraising universe within the context of price point?
Yeah. So when we were starting it up, it was a consideration. Again, I was vaguely aware of this world of like VC funding in the tech world. But ultimately, I knew I didn't come from that world. And it's like, well, I can spend the next 6 to 12 months like deep diving and trying to figure that out. But it's still not like it'd be a very academic view of it, not being really in it. So the simple instinct was like, I'd rather spend 6 to 12 months actually trying to build the thing than to go this route of trying to raise money. And I wouldn't even have had a great pitch deck anyway. Like, and they would have known that I don't come from that world. So, that just kind of naturally put us down the bootstrap route. So then, yeah, we really grew through our own like meager revenue growth for the first 2 years. Then I did like kind of turn the corner revenue wise, went up order of magnitude level with a couple big clients, and that allowed me, and this is where the serendipity is, right around the same time that I met Ben. And Ben and I actually met, he was at Accenture. He was in a procurement role specializing in mobility. So Ben was actually a potential client for me in my view and in his view as well. Like Accenture could potentially adopt our platform to offer to their clients was kind of where it started. And again, this came through a mutual introduction. But over 6 to 12 months, Ben was so intrigued in the business that he actually broached, you know, maybe there's a place for me in this. And that was right at the time where I'd gotten these two big contracts. Now I actually had a level of revenue where I could afford to bring someone like Ben into the business. And we were actually bringing two or three people into the business, all at once. So that's kind of how we got to that level. And then the first year with Ben, like a big year for both of us. Is this the right fit for both of us? And it was. So about a year or so in, I was more than happy to like give up the reins of the chief everything officer. And I felt Ben was much better suited for the CEO role. So I was happy to give that to him. And at the same time, he put some investment into the company as well. So that was kind of our next level. And from there, we took on, over the next few years, we had some additional investment from I think what you call high net worth individuals. So we didn't go to VCs. I did have some dalliances with like angel investors. They didn't never particularly went anywhere for, I guess, various reasons. They didn't pan out. And we have had a couple VCs take notice of us. But, you know, again, the thing is there, we're not trying to be a $1 billion business right now. And we don't want to pretend that we're going to be. So most VCs aren't terribly interested. We're just way below their radar, right? So I think we're kind of still in the right spot.
And I want to touch on that because, you know, I think there's such an obsession with raising VC money. And by the way, I think it's great. Like it accelerates growth. It plugs you into a group of people that are probably very experienced and they know great. I mean, there's so many benefits to it. But one of the detriments that I think isn't maybe talked about enough or perhaps is getting more airtime now is just this like crazy requirement to grow really fast, right? Sometimes to the detriment of the business and potentially. And I think knowing, you know, what you're saying about moving, I mean, for me on the immigration side, again, there are more companies that are seeing venture capital investment on the immigration technology side, but I just know how slow of a process, you know, the adoption and the sales piece is within the industry. Like it's just, it's not the kind of industry and potentially rightly so, where, you know, they see a company and they're like, great, let's throw $100,000 in their direction and see what happens. They can't do that because it's, you know, for me, it's legal, you know, they're legal matters. It's whether someone gets into a country or not, or, you know, or whatnot. Maybe, you know, for you, it's their stuff. Like, is this going to work? You know, is using this platform going to connect me to the right mover to help my employee who I care about dearly move that, you know, whatever. There's always sort of an additional layer, I think, of apprehension within our industries, you know, versus like, okay, a social media platform, great, I'll download it. If I hate it, I'll delete it. Like no harm, no foul, basically.
Right.
And so I think it's great that we take our time to a little bit, maybe more slowly and thoughtfully grow these businesses. But I argue that now that that's happened, right? And like for you, for example, you know, now that you raised some money from high net worth folks, or I guess you can call them, I guess they're not angel investors, but maybe a friends and family round, if you might call it that. And then you could bring that and say, look, there is a lot of potential here, mm-hmm. right? But this is how long it's taken us to get to here. Just an infusion of cash is not going to necessarily accelerate that growth. We're going to have to continue to steadily pound the pavement here, but your investment can help us over the next 5 to 7 years, not 1 to 2. Mm-hmm. So did you ever have that sort of maybe conversation or, you know, where folks showed interest and you were like, okay, great, but it's slow? Or was it always like, you know what, I'm not even going to try to get the VCs on board yet. I'm going to go with this sort of friends and family fundraise avenue.
Yeah. So there were a couple opportunities that came up and, you know, I think they didn't pan out in large part because again, I didn't come from that world. And so I didn't fit the mold of the typical guy that was pitching them. And so it was like, and so once I sensed that, it's like, well, I just didn't really try to waste my time going down that avenue anymore. Like, I think we certainly would be more interesting to that kind of investor now. So you mentioned funding growth. So for us, what that meant with much more modest investment is that we could have a staff of 7 people when we could only normally afford 3 or 4 people, and we can have a staff of 20 when we can only afford a staff of 10. Like that's what the investment has done for us, as opposed to, and so that still keeps in a very lean mindset. Like we were ultra lean bootstrap startup. If you don't have the revenue, you can't spend it. And if you get like $30 million thrown at you in a raise, it's just spending spree, right? And I get it. Cause like it's like, go, 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 go. But since we didn't do that route, like there's, I think, still a much more frugal mindset of don't like burn the money as slowly as you can. And, you know, really the best investment is that it allows us to staff, let's say 50 to 100% more people than we could have afforded. And that really does give you a huge advantage in growth, that it really accelerates you multiple years, conceivably, in contrast to it would have taken us another 2 years to get to that level where we could afford to add that staff. When you can do that a couple years in advance, then yeah, that's a big injection of for your growth.
That's awesome. Yeah, I like that too. Maybe again, because I'm coming from the same space, but it feels more manageable. I know a good amount of people who've gone to these super high growth startups, and it's exciting, right? Because like you said, it's a spending spree. And of course, a lot of them do really well, but you know, another large chunk of them can't handle the $30 million. You know what I mean? It's They hire hundreds of people and they fire the same 100 people the next year because, you know, they're in it over their head. So I love this sort of concept of it's okay to slowly and steadily grow a business. That's also sexy. It's not just raising $100 million that's sexy.
It sounds a lot smarter in hindsight too.
Definitely. And you know, I will say this, and I was just reading the news, you know, especially given this sort of maybe recession that we're going into, you know, we're right now, what is this, May 2022. I was just reading that investors are asking a lot more serious questions, you know, than they were in the past. You know, I'm on the East Coast where the investor sort of ethos has been, as far as I understand, you know, a little bit more conservative, right? I mean, it's the financial sector. They want to know that the fundamentals are strong, et cetera. Whereas, you know, coming from the East Coast, all I hear about the West Coast fundraising world is like, here you go. And, you know, do what you will, which is really cool, but also to your point, kind of sometimes not the best route for longevity. Okay. We can talk about that for forever. I want to kind of talk a little bit about price point today and sort of where you see the company, you know, going. You know, obviously this feels to me like this could be a company that you retire from, you know, over the next 20, 30 years that can continue to build, you know, more and more value to the industry, et cetera. Where do you see the company going, you know, from what you can share, at least over the next few years that you're excited about, or maybe especially based on the world we live in today with sort of remote work being more prevalent, work from anywhere, et cetera?
Yeah, I'm excited that our market penetration is still very early, but we have a very strong proof of concept with, you know, we've been adding some big blue chip Fortune 100 companies onto our platform and it's working. So I'm just excited for that growth over the next few years. And beyond that, like really long term, and this is not something we're really targeting at all, but I think the trajectory is that we probably end up in the consumer space. And we don't want to go directly after, I don't think that's something we would want to go after directly. So where there is VC money right now, it's going at the consumer space. The interesting thing though is from what I can see, it's a rush to like capture the client, like search engine optimization and all that, like getting in front of that client and winning their move. Very little back end focus on the boring stuff like actual pricing. So I've thought for a long time, like, it's like, okay, you guys go ahead and capture the clients. You're still going to need to figure out how to price that thing. And I'd say, I know that's something that's very complicated and I'm going to bet it's going to be over your head, especially if you don't have industry insiders. So my long-term thought is always, we want to be the de facto, this is how pricing is done in this industry. And as those other platforms go out and capture the client, we're the easy plug-in for them to actually put a price in front of them. Like, don't try to reinvent that wheel. It took us 10 years to do it. So I think eventually, like, look at the travel industry. We all use travel agents and then it went direct consumer, right? Our industry is in that phase right now where sorry, no offense, RMCs, but RMCs are kind of that travel agent. I don't think they're going to go away like travel agents did, but they're that intermediary. We can see what's going to happen. And this is already happening. Corporations will allow their employees to purchase this service just like you purchase your own airfare, right? And you book your own hotel. So I'm assuming 10 years down the line, that's going to be more and more common. So I think the whole industry is naturally going to gravitate towards the consumer space because that's what tech allows you to do. It decentralizes the industry. And so I think, again, I don't necessarily, we would want to target that, you know, unless some VC company came along and said they want to acquire us and they're going to go after it, who knows. But I don't think we want to target it. I like focusing on this very important cog in the whole process, which is having an actual pricing engine in a very complicated industry that most people don't understand. And we can plug that into all of these different companies who are trying to capture the client. Because we also really don't want to talk to the actual transferees. Mm-hmm. Going back to my first years in the industry where I had to deal with customers, yeah, that's we don't want that. We let the movers and everyone else do that.
It's fascinating. And you know, to make a comment about the sort of RMC piece of it, a lot of times with immigration technology, you know, there's the camp that says, well, the tech is going to make immigration lawyers obsolete. I don't think that's ever going to happen.
Right.
There are a myriad complicated issues where technology will probably never be sophisticated enough, or not at least in our life. I mean, in the foreseeable future, it won't be sophisticated enough. There's also a desire to have a human being that's responsible for some of this stuff. I suspect that there's also some people who just want to work with a lawyer. I don't care how good the tech is. I want a human being. Right. People will pay for that. People find value in that. I think that's the case in every industry that's seeing digitization right now. Including mobility. You're like, yeah, for sure. In some cases, really, really simple clients maybe don't need to work with an RMC and can do some of this stuff on their own. But a lot of companies just want to, number one, and others have to because it's so complicated, this web of, you know, providers and requirements, that I suspect the business will just be more interesting because folks who are in it get to actually think and be creative and like problem solve with their clients, and they let the technology handle the quote unquote low hanging fruit. I see that in the immigration space. And I suspect, you know, maybe that'll be partly within moving as well, where if it's a really easy move, yeah, you just go do it yourself. Kind of like a lump sum situation where the transferee just kind of does it. But then, yeah, something more complicated, a managing director of a large company is not going to do it themselves. They're going to have someone do it for them, period.
Right.
You know? So I'm excited. I'm definitely excited for that future of more robust technology that allows the companies that are doing the service now to go deeper and have more interesting work and more creative kind of use of their energy and time.
Yeah, because the RMC is like, and yeah, again, they're not going to go extinct or anything, but their role will certainly evolve. And they themselves spend a tremendous amount of time managing this pricing thing. It's like, or if they're trying to manage it well, they are. So they're eventually going to have to streamline that and recognize, no, you guys having a team of two or three people that tries to manage pricing from movers around the country and around the world, like, no, you're going to have to be more efficient with that. So that particular role, they're going to need to think about what the future looks like, because we can see what the trajectory is from these other industries.
Let me ask you this, as we kind of start to wrap up here, but I want to ask you this question, because it feels like, I mean, it's a private industry, but do you think there's any opportunity for pricing to be this sort of, I mean, to, for lack of a better word, kind of unionized concept where there is just the pricing of the industry so that people don't have to kind of play the game, whether it's agreed upon by everybody or, you know, there's like an association where everyone, you know, I don't know. Is there anything like that in the moving world, or is it really just, you know, pricing is a part of the sales process and, you know, where price point comes in is really making sense of that whole process?
So like, could the industry solve the problem for itself from a pricing standpoint?
I guess. Yeah. Like, can they say, okay, for this type of service, I guess that's sort of maybe collusion, if you will, but if it's agreed upon by everybody and it's known publicly, I don't know. I'm just thinking about that, given how many players there are in the industry and how complicated the whole thing is.
Yeah. So I think there's two things. First of all, you know, movers don't make great tech developers. So like, the future is certainly going to be solving the problem has to be tech-based. And it's not a core competency of moving companies. And then two, like, so going back to when I had the idea and was tinkering with, should I do this or not do this? One of my early thoughts, and this was kind of a cop-out, that I didn't really want to do a startup, but I thought I could partner with a company in the industry with deep pockets and develop it with them. But I thought about that for maybe a month or so, and I realized, well, if the industry is creating the solution, then the buyer can't trust it. right? Like, and that's what ultimately I realized, this has to be an independent company that creates this pricing solution, this pricing engine, because it needs to have objectivity. It needs to obviously not have a conflict of interest. It's like, if you're buying a car from a used car dealer, are you going to ask the car dealer, is this a good price? Right. Yeah, it's a great price, right? So, right. So the industry can't create the solution because there's inherently a conflict of interest.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That's really cool. Well, if I can ask you one kind of last question about this. Well, first of all, where can folks can find more, learn a bit more about PricePoint at pricepointmoves.com, right? And it sounds like really multiple parties can really learn about this. So obviously moving companies, but then of course the RMCs and corporates, you know, in-house mobility and relocation teams. Is there anyone else who, I don't know, DSPs, for example, around the world, or is that a little bit, yeah?
No, we hear that from time to time. Hey, you guys should, you know, do the price point for DSPs. And it's been an interesting thought, but it's like, stay focused. Try to solve too many things at one time. So, but yeah, that does come up from time to time. But we stick specifically to moving, international moving and domestic moving.
That's awesome. Cool. So for folks listening, check out, you know, learn more about PricePoint, pricepointmoves.com. And I'll have, you know, that information in the notes for the show, wherever you're watching or listening. And so Ryan, as my last kind of question, do you remember you spent a lot of time in the US and you finally, you know, your first time traveling abroad, it was to the UK. I'm just curious, do you have any memorable meals from the UK? And I sort of asked this in a, you know, I love the UK. I haven't been, I actually have to go back. It's, I was there like 9 years ago. But it's not a culinary destination, right. Yeah. I should say.
The best foods are all the non-English ones.
Right. So I'm curious, do you have any kind of like memorable dining experience, especially that was your first international trip? And a lot of people travel for food.
Yeah, you can't beat some chicken tikka masala in a pub, which is, well, so that's that's Indian, right? But as I understand it, they actually invented that dish in the UK. It's a British version of Indian food. That's great. And to be fair, fish and chips, that's great. Beyond that, yeah, it's like all of the, you know, London is one of the first and truest melting pots. And so all the food that came in from elsewhere, Thai food, Indian food, all that stuff. Yeah, I loved it.
That's awesome. And then were you happy to come back home to sort of good old comfort food?
It's so weird when you're overseas, you start craving the dumbest stuff like Taco Bell or something. Just because you haven't had it. Yes. And you can't have it.
That's
so
right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, it's always good to come back.
That's awesome. Well, Ryan, thank you so much. This has been such a great conversation. I've learned a lot and I love hearing your story. I think for me personally, it just mirrors so much of what I went through. And I kind of wish that I heard this conversation, you know, 5 years ago or so when I was just getting started with Laborless, because it would have made me feel that I wasn't alone. So yeah, appreciate you, you know, sharing, and really excited to continue watching the growth with PricePoint. And yeah, thank you for being here. I appreciate it.